Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It appears the juvenile was used as a human shield. The juvenile appeared to be uninjured.
Anchorage police shoot an armed man who tried to cover himself with a child. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Kuskokwim River residents ask state managers to reopen the river to fishing.
We are used to have fresh fish, and people are hungry right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
During COVID, rates of eating disorders have skyrocketed. If you're a parent with a child struggling with anorexia or concerning signs of restricted eating, help is available. The Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance, in partnership with UC San Diego, is offering a free 8-week online course to help parents learn how to improve communications and successfully help their child with an eating disorder move toward recovery. Free support groups will also be provided. More at akeatingdisordersalliance.org/workshops. This message sponsored by Akita.
Anchorage police say officers shot an armed man this morning after he held a child as a human shield. Anchorage Police Chief Michael Curl said at a news conference about the shooting that the dispute began at a North Anchorage home around 4:40 a.m.
During a domestic dispute, a suspect fired a shot inside a residence. No one was injured, and as a result of the shooting, the adult male suspect fled the scene with an elementary-aged juvenile and a gray Nissan Pathfinder.
Police have not yet identified the man. Curl said the man was related to the child but wouldn't comment further. Curl said an officer spotted the man's SUV around 6:30 a.m. near Lake Otis Parkway and Tudor Road. No one was in it. He said officers then saw the man trying to cross the street nearby with the child and confronted him. He said they determined he had a handgun.
Officers again ordered the suspect to stop, and he continued to ignore their commands and pointed his handgun at the officers. An officer discharged their weapon, and the suspect was struck in the midsection and taken into custody.
An officer fired twice at the suspect. Curl said the man tried to cover himself with the child.
It appears the juvenile was used as a human shield. The juvenile appeared to be uninjured.
Curl said the man doesn't have any life-threatening injuries. Officials said they won't name him until charges are filed. The State Office of Special Prosecutions is investigating the officer who fired their weapon to determine whether use of force was justified, said Curl. He said the officer will be placed on 4 days of administrative leave per APD policy, and their name will be released on Monday, 72 hours after the incident. Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Charlie Pierce announced today that he's resigning as mayor next month to focus full-time on his gubernatorial campaign. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has the story.
Pierce, a conservative from Sterling, is in his second term as mayor of the Kenai Peninsula Borough. He was first elected in 2017, and his current term doesn't end until late next year. He announced his resignation this morning on a conservative podcast and in a written statement posted to Facebook, and did not immediately respond to calls seeking comment. Pierce has previously said he'd plan an exit strategy if he advanced to the general election for Alaska governor, which he's appeared to do, per unofficial election results. Pierce and running mate Edie Grunwald are polling fourth in the governor's primary with about 6.7% of the total vote as of a Thursday update. They'll move ahead to the general election in November. They trail far behind the top three candidates. Incumbent Republican Mike Dunleavy is leading in the race with 41% of the vote. Democrat Les Guerra and independent Bill Walker each have just over 22%. Pierce told his former chief of staff, John Quick, on the Must Read Alaska podcast that his resignation is effective the end of the day, September 30th.
So I'm going to go campaign, and, it was my campaign team's desire for me to do this much earlier, but putting a plan together and I will help through the transition
Alaska statute says if a mayor resigns more than 6 months before a regular election, the borough must hold a special election to fill the remainder of the term. In the short term, the mayor has an administrative officer who's designated to carry out his powers when he can't, according to borough code. That designated authority is the borough's chief of staff, Aaron Rhodes. Borough Finance Director Brandy Harbaugh is an alternate. Borough Attorney Sean Kelly says the legal department will publish a memo to the assembly about the succession process next week. Before Charlie Pierce was borough mayor, he served on the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly and was a manager at NSTAR. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Kuskokwim River residents are urging state fishery managers to open the river one day per week to gill nets. Last week, for the first time ever, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed the river and nearly all tributaries to gill nets and coho salmon harvest. The month-long closure is meant to conserve the near-record-low coho run. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports residents are asking managers to compromise with people who need fish.
According to at least one measurement, the Kuskokwim River coho salmon run is the second lowest ever recorded. That's according to the state-run Bethel Test Fishery, which has been operating for nearly 40 years. That project and the state sonar are both closing this week. Fishery managers will no longer measure how many coho are entering the river this season, but the river will remain closed. Ross Rennick is a state fishery biologist.
Any coho harvest right now at this time we see as an impact on future years, essentially.
Under the current regulations, gill nets are prohibited in nearly all flowing water to prevent nets from snagging coho salmon. But gill nets are allowed in non-flowing water, like ponds and oxbow lakes, to target whitefish, pike, and other non-salmon. These non-flowing waters are not evenly distributed or accessible along the river. Near Akiak, where Mike Williams Sr. lives, they're sparse.
We are used to have fresh fish, and people are hungry right now.
Williams sits on the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group. It's a group of river residents who advise state fishery managers on salmon management. The members unanimously passed a motion asking the state to open the upper river above Aniak to gillnets one day a week until the closure ends on September 15th. Coho had just started reaching these waters when the closure took effect, cutting communities off from harvesting the fish. Barbara Carlson lives in Sleetmute along the upper river. She proposed the weekly openings.
I do recognize the numbers are low. This is not going to give us enough fish to put fish up, but it might give us a chance to make a gudeg with fresh white fish and have a couple of silvers to eat.
Silvers, or coho, have become a critical protein source in the upper river as other salmon species have declined reaching the headwaters. Without whitefish, people are unable to make a gudeg with the berries they're picking. The group also discussed reasons for managers to open the lower river to gillnets for at least a few hours each week to target whitefish. Guithluk resident John Andrew said that with moose season opening soon, fewer people would be fishing, which would lessen possible pressure on coho. Andrew, who is an elder, said other elders are calling him, asking for salmon to jar and ferment. He supported limited fishing openings.
We'd be really happy. Everybody's hurting for the fish right now.
Residents asked managers why they couldn't use 4-inch mesh gill nets on the river. The nets are considered non-salmon gear, and they're allowed on the Yukon River, where coho fishing is also closed due to low returns. State fishery manager Chuck Brazil said regulations won't allow that on the Kuskokwim. Managers can either allow all gill nets or prohibit them, but not limit mesh size during salmon conservation. He said the Board of Fish will consider a proposal at its next meeting to change that. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a battle of the buds gets underway within Alaska's unique cannabis industry.
So it's still an awesome group of just passionate, homegrown people, you know, with small operations, mom and pop shops.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Democrat Mary Peltola is slowly widening her lead over Republican Sarah Palin in the special election for U.S. House as new vote totals are released. The Division of Elections released an update late last night with an additional 5,000 votes counted since Tuesday. Peltola increased her lead from 7.5% to a little over 8%. She now holds 39.3% of the vote, Palin has 31.2%, and Republican Nick Begich follows with 28%. The additional votes counted include early absentee and question ballots from multiple districts. In this ranked choice election, the candidate with the least votes will be eliminated first. Their ballots will be reallocated according to the voter's second choice. The division won't begin ranking candidates, though, until August 31st, the deadline for mail-in ballots to arrive. The winner of this election will serve the remainder of the late Congressman Don Young's term until January. Active duty airmen will soon drive school buses for students at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Anchorage School District officials announced today that the airmen will drive students for 90 days starting Thursday. The four drivers who currently staff the routes on J-Bear will move to other routes in the district. The district is currently down 66 drivers. 25 new hires are in training and 17 others will be returning to the district from other jobs by September 19th. Superintendent Jarrett Bryant says they're interviewing 21 additional candidates.
So what that means is that we're within arm's reach of our goal of being fully staffed by October.
As new drivers have started working, the district has reinstated routes based on student needs and safety. Six routes have been reinstated so far. Bryant says the district has also been working with the city of Anchorage and the state of Alaska to adjust traffic flow as more parents have been driving to schools and more kids have been walking.
To make adjustments to traffic lights as appropriate, to monitor traffic, and to make sure that students are safe if they're walking to school in lieu of being on a school bus.
The district has also started a third-party audit of its transportation operations to avoid similar shortages in the future. Bryant said that could lead to changes for the district, including using a new kind of routing software, adjusting school start times, and combining routes. Senator Dan Sullivan is introducing legislation that goes after illegal Chinese fishing operations in federal waters off the coast of Alaska. Sullivan announced the Fighting Foreign Illegal Seafood Harvest Act, also known as the Fish Act, on a visit to Kodiak yesterday. Sullivan says Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island helped author the bill.
This is a very bipartisan bill and a very needed bill.
The Fish Act directs the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to compile a blacklist of foreign vessels that have engaged in unsanctioned fishing and ban them from U.S. ports. It also beefs up the Coast Guard's ability to inspect foreign ships, and it calls for more regular reports to Congress on illegal fishing activities. The legislation cites all foreign ships, but Sullivan says it specifically addresses current transgressions by Chinese boats in federal and international waters. He says it was drafted with input from NOAA and officials from the Coast Guard and has broad support in Washington, D.C.
Senators who are very hawkish against China are focused on this. People who want to keep our fisheries strong and sustainable are focused on this. This unites kind of all different stakeholder groups.
Sullivan and Senator Lisa Murkowski were in Kodiak for a meeting with fisheries managers and officials from NOAA. Members of Congress are currently on summer recess, and there is no timeline to vote on the bill. Earlier this week, Senator Murkowski traveled to Unalaska as part of an effort to spur the United States government to clean up contaminated lands conveyed to Alaska Natives. KUCB's Theo Greenlee has more.
The U.S. government conveyed 44 million acres of land to Alaska Natives as part of the 1971 Alaska Native Corporation Settlement Act, or ANCSA. But lots of that land was polluted by things like mining and military operations. And so for the past 50 years, different organizations have been arguing over whose responsibility it is to clean it up.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm calling to order.
Senator Lisa Murkowski co-chairs the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs.
This is an official United States Senate hearing.
She and a group of state and federal officials held a Senate hearing in Unalaska Tuesday to organize cleanup efforts to some of that polluted land.
People are looking for an actionable plan. To me, what we're discussing today is really environmental injustice, true environmental injustice. We're talking about lands that the federal government conveyed to Alaska Native corporations to settle Aboriginal land claims that were often horribly contaminated.
Pressure has been rising for the government to do something. The state of Alaska sued the feds in July, arguing that the Anxa land was too polluted to develop and that the Department of the Interior had to act. Jason Bruni is the commissioner for Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation, and he told Tuesday's panel that litigation was Alaska's only choice.
We had to bring litigation against the Department of the Interior, against the Bureau of Land Management. We did not want to bring litigation. We were hoping, and we've been trying to resolve this. And we all recognize this as an issue, but we ultimately, the force of litigation has ultimately brought us together.
The community of Unalaska has more than 50 sites that have been deemed areas of concern, covering around 80,000 acres. Vince Tudiakoff Sr. is the mayor of Unalaska. He's also the traditional chief of the Kowalungan tribe of Unalaska and chairs the board of Unalaska's Native Corporation. He said they've been petitioning the government to do something for decades.
We're tired of it. Every time we get a letter back, oh, we're going to confirm this, then we're going to start a study. Well, we've been studied enough. I think it's time to take all these studies and put them up on the shelf. They've been studied enough. Come out here. Send people out here.
Murkowski ended the hearing by directing the Department of the Interior to step up to be the coordinating agency. She said it was their responsibility and that she expected them to act immediately.
So I would like to know that by the end of this week, we can get some kind of a determination from Interior as to a commitment as a coordinating agency.
And if the Department of the Interior doesn't take up that effort, Murkowski said she'd take action.
Expect an answer. And if I need to legislate an answer, I will.
Anyone who wants to submit public testimony can send it to testimony@indian.senate.gov. In Unalaska, I'm Theo Greenlee.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank, Alaska, celebrating 100 years of helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
A two-year process that was stalling cleanup efforts at a mine upstream of Southeast Alaska has come to a close. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, that could speed up remediation of the Tulsiqua Chief Mine.
The Tulsiqua Chief Mine is in Canada, about 20 miles from the Alaska border near Juneau. It extracted zinc, copper, and lead in the 1950s, and ever since, rusty acidic runoff from the mine's tunnels and leftover waste rock has been flowing into a tributary of the Taku River, a major salmon-producing waterway.
For 65 years, it's been leaking acid mine drainage pretty much unabated into the watershed.
Guy Archibald is the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission. The group represents 15 tribes in the region concerned with toxic waste from Canada's mines. The British Columbia government has said it's committed to cleanup efforts, but in recent years, the process has been held up in court. In 2016, a company that had hoped to get the mine going again, Chieftain Metals, filed for bankruptcy and was put into receivership. That means a third-party firm, West Face Capital, was managing the mine's assets, hoping to recoup nearly $50 million of investments in the project. Eventually, a Canadian court gave the investors a two-year deadline to ask for an extension on the receivership, and that ended August 11th. Archibald says it's a big step towards getting the mine cleaned up.
This is a long time coming, and I'm glad to see it.
West Face Capital did not return a request for comment. Though BC's mining ministry released a 113-page remediation plan and says it's performed some interim reclamation work the last three summers, environmental groups say the end of receivership will allow the BC government to take responsibility for the site and start a more substantial cleanup process. The government has been criticized for downplaying its environmental impact.
I think BC, you know, sees this as a black mark, and they definitely want to get rid of it and prove that they can do the job right here.
Chris Zimmer is with Rivers Without Borders, an environmental watchdog group in Juneau that follows transboundary mining activity. He says BC can now move forward with cleanup.
The BC government for a couple of years has been saying that this bankruptcy receivership process has hindered them, has tied their hands, has limited their abilities to actually get in there and physically clean up the mine and shut it down.
There are still a few steps before that can happen. Chieftain Metals must dissolve. An official with BC's mine division says that's expected to happen this fall. Zimmer says there is a long road ahead for remediation.
It's going to take a bit of time, certainly, to get the cleanup together and deal with the engineering challenges. So we're hoping to see BC right away start firming up its plans, creating budgets, and hopefully becoming a bit more transparent with us here in Alaska so we know what's going on.
The BC Ministry of Mines did not respond to requests for comment. Although Tulsiquitchief Mine is small compared to other transboundary mines in Southeast and many that are proposed for development, Archibald says all eyes are on it.
It's kind of the poster child for, you know, bad Canadian mining practices.
He says it could set a precedent for how the government deals with the industry. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
A battle of the buds gets underway tomorrow in Alaska as High Times Magazine's Cannabis Cup competition returns to the state. High Times bills itself as the most globally recognized brand in cannabis after starting its counterculture magazine nearly 50 years ago, and says its Cannabis Cup is a continuation of the competitions held in Amsterdam starting in the 1980s. Now, though, it's possible to hold the competitions legally in the United States, some of them anyway. High Times Director of Events and Competitions Mark Kazanek says Alaska, as the second state to legalize recreational use of marijuana in 2015, with its now robust cannabis industry, is a great place for a competition. And as an outside observer, Kazanek says there are some unique and interesting things about the cannabis industry here.
Yeah, I think Alaska has an amazing market. It's still developing, which is great because the MSOs, the multi-state operators, the huge, you know, Walmarts of the cannabis industry haven't attacked Alaska yet. And it's not always a bad thing, but it will, you know, it's bad for the smaller growers where, you know, they have their business, but if somebody else bigger is coming in and they're able to sell their cannabis to dispensaries at a cheaper price, those dispensaries will likely take them up on it because their margins will be better. So we haven't seen that in Alaska yet. So it's still an awesome group of just passionate, homegrown people, you know, with small operations, mom and pop shops or, you know, whatever else, where they care about what's going on. They're keeping their operations small. It's craft cannabis. We think this is just a great place to be because there's still a lot of licenses, but they actually care about it and they're producing their own product instead of just licensing it out to somebody else or having some huge manufacturing operation where they can't even do as much quality control as somebody with a smaller operation could do.
You mentioned earlier some of those big brands outside the state hadn't gotten here yet. So I have to ask you, I mean, do you see that happening here?
In most states, you'll see that. I think every big company, MSO, you know, multi-state operator wants to try to expand their operations into as many states as possible. You know, it's just, it's for economic reasons and just branding reasons. But, you know, after working with some of the lawyers here in Alaska, I think that there is some good language written into the Alaska legislation about cannabis that doesn't accept outside money. So it might be protected, at least for now. I don't know if those regulations will change, but I think Alaska right now is protected from outside investments, outside funding. Mm-hmm. So if any of these big operators want to come out, they got to build a staff, have them live in Alaska for a while, get a light, you know, and then get a license and then be able to operate. So it's a little bit tougher here, which I think is pretty cool for Alaska to do.
So how does this competition work? You mentioned a little bit already about the kit that folks get, and it sounds like there are different judges or sets of judges maybe for different categories, right?
Yep.
What do they look at? I mean, how nerdy does this get? You know, I mean, no offense, but like how closely are they analyzing the pot, and like what do they do beyond, you know, smoking it?
Yeah, so we want people to be extremely nerdy or just very very thorough, you know? So the products are organized amongst 9 categories. So we have sativa flower, hybrid flower, indica flower. We have vape pens as a category, concentrates as a category. Then we have pre-rolls as a category, infused pre-rolls as a category, which is flower plus concentrates rolled up into, you know, a joint. And then lastly, we have 2 edibles categories, one for gummies and one for non-gummies, which is typically comprised of chocolates, cookies, baked goods, even capsules sometimes, including here in Alaska. So 9 categories to choose from and to judge from. So they go to the dispensary, they're buying that judge kit and they're judging that category. It's going to ask them how they rank aesthetics, so how things look 1 through 10, with 1 being least favorable, 10 being most favorable. Also judging aroma, judging taste, effects, burnability, different criteria for different categories, with comments in each of those sections, and then 1 last final section for just a full experience, you know, tell us about your journey. And it all goes back to the vendors on an anonymous, you know, fashion.
Interesting. Yeah. To be clear, you're not ready to say that Alaska has the best cannabis of any state. You know, we think we're better than everybody else.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah. I guess we'll see. I mean, it's hard because it's not federally legalized. So you can't compare Alaska cannabis in a legal and compliant setting to California cannabis. You can't have a judge test both in one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens from this competition. And then as the government, you know, potentially federally legalizes, which I think has a lot of cons to it, a lot of pros to it as well. And then maybe we can try to do some interstate competitions where we can bring in multiple states into one location, bring that product together, and make a judging sample kit from that.
That was Mark Kazanek, Director of Events and Competitions at High Times Magazine. More information about the Cannabis Cup is at cannabiscup.com. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early in Kavitha, George in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.